Collection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, why not hold it to false use? The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Oh, I thought for being away there'd be no questions tonight.
Oh my goodness.
Very good. Okay, see what we have here. Is the property opposite Jhana Grove a national park? Can we walk outside there? Which side? That side, that side, that side, that side. Actually, they're all mostly national park. The north side, which is that way, that is, belongs to other people. I'll just go and see what happens. If you don't see any signs there, then you can have a walk there. But don't forget to find your way back, because the national park, it's a national park that way, and it's very big. Otherwise, you go wandering and wandering and wandering and wandering. Is the peace indicator you talked about only applies in meditation or in daily life as well, but we have to plan, work, think in life? How possible? Oh, you can still plan peacefully. You can talk peacefully. And if you find yourself getting too agitated when you are working, you find your productivity goes down. As you all know, if you're doing an examination and you get agitated, you don't perform well. If you relax, you perform really well. It's very, very unfair. It is the Jewish school in Perth, Carmel, they keep inviting me there just before year 12 to teach their children how to do year 12, and they get the best results of any school in Perth. I remember about 2 or 3 years ago when I went there to teach the kids how to do exams, the principal sent me a nice letter afterwards, thank you so much, the best results ever. And I don't teach any other schools. It's like performance enhancing meditation. Should be illegal. But that was just in passing exams. Say Novak Djokovic, he meditates and that's why he gets the number one. And many other people in there, I mentioned to a few people when I went to Google and Facebook, there were meditation rooms in those places. Any time of the day or night, people could go there and just meditate on the Google's time. It was very easy to find the meditation room. You didn't need to search for it. Ha, ha, ha. Okay, never mind. I tried my best. Google search. Okay, never mind. For someone attained on the path, does she, he still like and enjoy the company of certain people more than others? Or like certain food, etc.? Is it okay still to have preferences? Of course, if you're on the path, you can still have preferences. It depends on how much of the path you're on. And sometimes that part of the path, the deeper you get, the less your preferences are. But still, there's a preferences for your health, so that you can always make sure that the food you eat is the food which is going to be good for you. But even the food which is bad for you, if you're a Buddha, you still choose to eat it, like he ate the pork at the end of his life. And it killed him. But I ask you, did the Buddha know that his last meal was going to kill him? Did he know? Well, if he did, then he committed suicide. A deliberate act. He knew that last curry from Chunda the Smith was going to kill him, and he still ate it. Isn't that suicide? I love stirring people up. Just to make people think in a different way. So, that was why that once we had a competition in on my New Year's Eve party. And one of the questions was in Dhammaloka, what were the last words of the Buddha? The last words before he passed away. Now I know most people think it's like strive on with diligence and that sort of stuff. But the person who won was very inventive. They thought the real last words of the Buddha, the real ones, which didn't actually get into the book, was don't touch the curry. That's more like it, isn't it? Anyway, yeah, you do have some preferences, but that's just the case of... there's another one which has all been wrapped up here. What's this one here? The smiley face. Okay, thank you very much, the smiley face. Metta. Excellent. That doesn't need any answer. That is a question without an answer. Wow. Dear Venerable Sir, I'm really enjoying peaceful days with silence, calm and quiet environment, and importantly with no phone calls, emails and deadlines. Exactly. How do I keep this peace of mind even after going to back to my family and workplace, which is like the Armadale shopping mall, like the lady who went to the mall in your talk last night? Easy. Just throw away your iPhone, your tablet, and just... let other people worry about that. So, one thing, I've been talking about that in monastery, that there are many companies, I think someone said Volkswagen, who only allow, I think they cut off everyone's email on the weekend. So, you know, that thing Volkswagen, they've got their own email server, like the BSWA, has got its email server, and on the weekend, they shut it down. So, you can't get any emails from BSWA on the weekend. Would that be a good idea? So it means that you can actually have quiet time for everybody. So I'm sure you can get some app, Prashant, to shut down my email for, you know, certain times of the day or night time. So you can download that app and it means the emails, they shut down. You can't access them, you can't send them, say from, I don't know, on the weekends, public holidays, maybe from... after 9 p.m. until 8 o'clock the following morning. Why'd you put that in? It's really difficult to unlock. So you can do things like that. So you can... You don't need to keep answering all the time. It's like an obsession. So, and you got your family and workplace. Actually, that's what... 2 years ago, they had this conference in San Francisco. All the big IT... companies were there, and the conference had a theme, like a slogan, like many conferences have. And their slogan was, disconnect to connect. It's a very nice little word, disconnect from all your, you know, electronic stuffs, so you can connect to your family, to yourself, to life. Very, very wonderful little idea. So it's up to you to have a little bit of self-discipline there so that you can enjoy your family and workplace. And you can keep that peace of mind, at least keep a lot of it. When I begin to see the breath, I feel short breath with increased rate. This is tiring for me. I think I'm controlling my respiration without my intention. How do I overcome this problem? What you can do, as I said this to someone in interviews, you can look upon your breath like a friend. Not like a slave, or like a servant, or like someone who works for you and you're their boss. Treat your breath with respect and with equality, and with friendship, and start thinking, your breath, I did this once, I looked at my breath and said, you've been coming in and out of my body for over 60 years, day and night, 7 days a week, you haven't taken any holidays, breath. And you've been doing this all this time, keeping me healthy. Thank you so much, breath. I have this beautiful feeling of gratitude towards my breath for keeping me healthy. Who else would work for you day and night without rest for such a long time? Your breath does. So when you have a nice attitude towards your breath, ah, thank you, breath. You're just so devoted to me. And so then I look at my breath like that, change the attitude towards it. You can't control it. You have respect it, have gratitude towards it, have a soft mind towards it. And then it always goes in so smoothly and goes out so smoothly. So you can, it's called in English to anthropomorphize. Look at something which isn't really a being and make it into a being. You know, imagine a teddy bear like it's a being. You can cuddle it, it's your friend. It's meditating with you. You can imagine your breath like that too. And it's wonderful that sometimes machines or bears and stuff, they do sometimes appear to have a life of their own. I do remember an old cement mixer a long time ago. When I was the main builder, you know, my cement mixer, I got it from Welshpool, and I used to use it. It was my cement mixer, making lots of... Half the monastery was built under that cement mixer. And when it got a bit old, other monks tried to use it. They could not get it to work. But every time I used it, I gave it a stroke. Just one more time, cement mixer. I know you're tired. Come on. And every time, it would work for me, every time, no problem at all. Because I was kind to it. And that also happens, people tell me, to their cars as well. If you have a problem with your car, if you're kind to it, it can sometimes work. Somebody in Perth told me that they were working in this big office, and the photocopier was bust. So they put a big sign on it, photocopier not working. But unfortunately the sign just fell off and onto the floor, and this guy came up to it. It's our photocopier, you know, I've got a few photos, can you work for me today? And so he spoke to it very nicely and put the stuff in, and it worked. No one could believe that he got it to work. So sometimes machines, if you're kind to them, it's amazing just how much they would work. When I went to Norway once to give a talk, the boom gates in the car park of the airport were stuck. And people were just getting very, very upset. I just went up to them and said, oh, may all your boom gates be happy and well. And they started working. And my driver was really impressed. But the best story was actually, I wrote about it in the Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And that was the story, that this is absolutely true, incredible but true, when NASA in Houston installing a new big mainframe computer. The big number cruncher. Millions of dollars worth of equipment. And once installed, installed all the software, booted up, and they couldn't get it booted up. Didn't know what was wrong. They couldn't fix it. And they flew in, first class tickets, all the experts they could possibly find in North America to try and fix it. No one could fix it. After several days, they were getting very concerned. This was costing them a lot of money. And it just so happened that one of the engineers in NASA, Houston, Texas, who was on this job of installing the supercomputer, one of them mentioned, well, if we can't fix it, perhaps, just perhaps, it's something supernatural. That's what he said, apparently. He said, I know the very person who can fix it. Because there happened to be a monk in the temple in Houston who had a lot of good reputation for things like psychic powers. So they invited him in to the mainframe computer room in NASA. Got all the security clearance for him. Because a monk doesn't cost anything. Or maybe a cup of tea and you get this incredible service. And he just went into the mainframe computer room and meditated and spread metta, and the computer worked perfectly afterwards. He fixed it. And that's not an exaggeration. Because we found that out when this monk, he was coming a second time to San Francisco, or maybe in the same trip, it must have been another trip. A subsequent trip, he arrived in San Francisco airport, one of our monks was Ajahn Pasano, met him at the airport, And just to check and make sure his visa was okay, his eyes almost popped out of his head when he saw that this Thai forest monk, with no connections to royal family or generals or wealthy people, had a diplomatic visa with no expiry date for the rest of his life to enter the United States whenever he wanted. And he asked, "Where did you get this visa from?" And he said, "From NASA." They decided out of gratitude. That's what he said, out of gratitude. They couldn't give him much, but give him a visa. But I don't think it was really gratitude. I think it was more like selfishness. So if they needed him in a rush, he already had his visa. And he was the same monk who, just, you know, someone asked me about psychic powers and stuff. You know, they do exist. And it's sometimes a bit worrying when you know how these things work, because this monk, when he arrived at the airport in San Francisco, Ajahn Pasno, his yam, his bag, Nibuto, you've got a bag here, could you lift up your monk's bag? There are these monk's bags which we have. And Ajahn Pasno was fiddling with the zip was stuck. And this monk saw that, and he said, "Oh, your zip's stuck." He said, "Yeah, I can fix that for you," said the senior monk. And he opened up his robe, and inside, on his inner vest, he had all these pockets with all these tools. Screwdrivers, pliers, knives, wrenches. And this monk, Ajahn Pasno, "Did you carry that on board the aircraft?" "Oh yeah, I always do." "Well, what happens when you pass through those electronic gates?" "Oh, I just do my metta and nothing beeps." So, you aren't safe when you go on board a plane. Some people are carrying so many tools inside. But you don't have to worry. They're not Islamic terrorists. They're Buddhist monks who are very, very, very safe. But that's what he does, and it's incredible. He can do that. Never gets caught. He just loses his mind, and just those machines, they can't spot him at all. Amazing. It's absolutely true. So he fixes up the computer. So you can have some influence on machines. And if you can do it on machines, imagine how much influence you can have on your breath to make that really calm and peaceful by being kind to it. "Dear Ajahn, could the enlightened superfood be..." Very good. Someone asked the other day, "Is there an enlightened superfood?" And I think somebody has got it here. Nibbanana. That's pretty good. Whoever did that, Nibbanana, the superfood. "Can we see the ordination ceremony on Sunday, please?" If you can get there. The ordination says a nun's ordination ceremony at Dharmasala. I don't know really what time it is yet. I'm supposed to go, but I haven't made any arrangements yet, because live in the present moment. When it happens, it happens. But yeah, you'd have to ask the nuns about that. But getting there is a trouble, because there's no transport for you here unless you've got your own car. The monk's transport is probably already full. So if you, it's on Sunday. So, yeah, if you leave tomorrow morning, you should be able to get there by walking. That will show you really want to see it. "Dear Ajahn Brahm, can we meditate with eyes half opened and half closed?" You can if you want, but it's a waste of time. If you do anything, you've got to give it everything you've got. Do it properly. Don't do things half-heartedly. That's why I do sadhus. I don't do sadhus. I give it everything I've got. When I chant, I give it my everything. When I give talks, I give everything I've got. Whatever I do in life, I give everything I've got. So if you keep your eyes open, keep them open. Keep them closed, keep them closed. Do it properly. But that's the story I gave. There was, again, a lovely story about how to be successful in meditation and life. This man came along to see me. He was from Sydney. And he told me that when Ajahn Chah, my teacher, was still alive, he went to see him. Because he heard about this monk, and he had all these questions he wanted to ask, like, you know, you have questions you'd love to ask. And he decided to go all the way to Thailand, to the northeast. Not to go on holiday, go to the beach or go anywhere, shopping or anything. Just to see Ajahn Chah, ask his questions and come back again to Sydney. For one reason only. And it's a difficult place to get to Ajahn Chah's monastery. When he finally arrived, he got there. And then he went, found out where Ajahn Chah was, and there Ajahn Chah was, underneath his hut where he usually received guests. 100, 200 people around him, all wanting to ask their questions. And there he was on the outside, waiting, waiting, waiting. After a couple of hours, he realized there's no way that he could see this very famous and popular monk. Just, you know, he hadn't advanced in the queue, if there was a queue, at all. So he gave up. All that way, disappointed. And as he went for a walk, as he was walking back to where the taxi was supposed to meet him, he realized he still had another hour before the taxi would come. So what did he do? He saw some monks sweeping the grounds. He thought, I will sweep as well. At least I can make some good karma. And that's an interesting point there, because when you don't think of yourself, but you look after the temple, the monasteries, or wherever you are, you know, it may not be your job to help with the washing up, but you know, you need to make a bit more karma. You help with the washing up anyway. That's what he did. He started sweeping, and only after about 10 minutes of sweeping, he felt a hand on his shoulder, and he turned around. It belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had seen him in the distance. He has powers. He knew that this poor man had come all the way from Australia just to see him. Would not have any other chance like the locals had a chance every day. But he didn't have time to answer any questions. So he just gave him a very quick Dhamma teaching. One of these great one-liners which change your life. And the Dhamma teaching he gave to this young man from Sydney was, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then Ajahn Chah left. And that young man thought about that on the way back to Sydney. And realize he's not just talking about sweeping, he's talking about life. Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. If you're sleeping, don't go meditating or planning the next day. Give sleeping everything you've got. When you have your breakfast, you don't watch your breath. You focus on the breakfast. Give eating the breakfast everything you've got. You know, when you're having your shower, be mindful, be with the shower. Wash your body the best you possibly can. And when you're meditating, give meditating everything you've got. When he was at work, he didn't meditate or think of his family when he was at work. He gave work everything he got. And when he was resting at night, he gave rest everything he got. And he said that that single teaching made him a very wealthy man, really happy relationship with his wife and kids, and a very good meditation. Every moment he gave 100% to what he was doing. And that was the success of his life. Very, very simple teaching. I encourage you to do that. When you're meditating, meditate. Don't go planning where you're going to go next. When you're resting, you're in bed, learn how to sleep full on, 100%. And at the end of the retreat, when you make a donation, give it everything you've got. That's what I've said many times. It doesn't work. Anyway, that's half open, half closed. You can try it if you wish, see if it works, but it usually doesn't. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is there a possibility that you'll be leading longer retreats at Jhana Grove in the future, e.g. 2 or 3 week retreats with gratitude? I don't even lead 9-day retreats. I only lead 1-moment retreats. Present moment awareness. 9 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 1 moment. What's the difference? Is there a difference? Dear Ajahn, how to meditate in terms of space element and vijnana element? To be able to really do things like that, you need the jhanas first of all. Powerful, strong minds. Actually, probably tomorrow morning, I only just scratched an insight this morning. When it's space, what do you think space is? A lot of times that people have ideas, but they don't really understand it. Their mind is not powerful enough yet. So if you want to understand what consciousness is and what space or emptiness is, this is not just easy stuff. You can have a very powerful mind, a mind which is still enough to be able to have enough mindfulness you can perceive these things. When you can't even perceive the breath for more than a couple of minutes, there's not going to be any opportunity to do space or consciousness. But maybe I might talk a little bit about that tomorrow. Next one. Dear Ajahn, most ancient cultures had a shamanistic tradition which utilized psychedelics found in plants and mushrooms, e.g. soma, ayahuasca, and psychosobrilib, which produced fairly consistent results from not too dissimilar from near-death experience. What place, if any, do you think psychedelics play in the spiritual journey, and how do the experience reported relate to Buddhist cosmology? And the Buddha made a very strong point of not having any psychedelics, no drugs at all, you know, for anyone keeping five precepts. And of course, you know, I was born in the 60s when things like LSD got very, very popular. And I was very fortunate with drugs. The only reason I didn't really get into them, because one of my best friends was caught with marijuana, and he told me, I remember on the bus going home one day from school, that his life is in a big mess because they told his parents, and his parents went ballistic that he was taking marijuana. And at that time, my father was so sick, he would die soon. And I thought to myself, if I take drugs and get caught, which is a possibility, and my father finds out, he would be pushed over the edge straight away. He would die. There's no way I was going to do that to my father. Because whether it was right or wrong, it would kill him. And he was on the edge of life and death for a long time. And that kept me off marijuana when I was young, until I went to university, and then I became a Buddhist, and that continued to keep me off it. But I saw many of my friends get into that stuff. And people say gateway drugs. My experience was they were gateway drugs. One of my best friends, he got a scholarship to study medicine in Cambridge. And before he finished on medicine, he became a heroin addict. And I saw him about 10 or 15 years ago. He could have been a great doctor, and he was just getting by mowing lawns on people's gardens. And that's all he could do. Another friend, you know, who got into drugs, he was in jail for dealing drugs. Another of my friends, he was head of the teepee people who went around Wales living in teepees. Crazy people. And these were very, very high-flying, very intelligent young men who wasted their lives. So I don't really have too much sympathy for people who take even psychedelics. Seeing them, I personally haven't seen any positive results from these things. And anyway, you don't really need them. This is artificial. They don't really give you an accurate mindfulness. I haven't taken these, but from all that I have heard about them, your mindfulness is not strong when you have these psychedelics. You have visions, and sometimes they can be, as they used to say, bad trips. All it's doing, if you have any negativity there, it will amplify that and make it even more negative. And sometimes people have psychoses as a result of those, which last the rest of their life. If you meditate, you don't have any bad side effects whatsoever. Maybe developing your mindfulness and jhanas are harder. It's not just taking a pill or some mushroom. It's much harder to do it this way, but it's much safer. People always like the easy way, the quick way, but it's usually the dangerous way. So that's my personal view on that one. Dear Ajahn, what is the meaning of breath is coming to you? Please explain a little bit about this. All it really means is when there's nothing else to watch, then the only thing left moving is all you can watch. So it is the case that when you're sitting down, you close your eyes, not half closed, totally closed, there's nothing to look at. And because you see the inside of your eyelids when you first close your eyes, and because that stays perfectly still, it doesn't change, you notice that the sense of sight turns off. So it gave the simile of the computer screen. If nothing's happening, it just turns off, it goes blank. And the same happens with the other five senses. Hearing, as long as there's no bangs, the sound of the aircon, which you can hear now, after a while you can't hear it anymore. Simply because it doesn't change, therefore it disappears. And when everything else is still, you're not thinking, not past, no future, then the only other thing which you can be aware of is your breathing. When I first came to Perth, the first few weeks, somebody came to our temple in North Perth, and they said that they had imported one of these sensory deprivation chambers. These little, like coffins made of plastic in which was perfectly dark, didn't allow in any light, and it has to have some sort of system for ventilating it, but it was floating in water, salt water, which is exactly the same density as your body. So you floated there. So you had no pressure on your bottom, on your knees, or anything. So you wouldn't feel anything. And it was soundproof. And it was supposed to enhance your meditation, to turn off the senses. You couldn't see anything, you couldn't hear anything, you couldn't feel anything, because you're just floating in salt water at body temperature. And I was interested to try that out. But in our tradition, the senior monk has the first go. And that was my senior Ajahn Chakra. So he had a go at it. And I was supposed to go the next day. Never got a chance because someone came to the temple. I looked at the newspaper, the West Australian. There was a big advertisement there. Sensory deprivation chamber. I think $50 an hour or something. As used by Buddhist monks. They conned us because they invited us to go there just to test it out so they could use that in their advertising campaign as used by Buddhist monks. So I got banned from doing it. But I did ask, what was it like? And he said, yeah, you can't see anything and you can't hear anything and your body, you can't feel anything in your body except because you can't shut that out of a sensory deprivation chamber. You take that inside with you. And he said that was so prominent, watching your breathing, because that's the only thing left. That's what I mean by the breath comes to you. When everything else disappears, that's the last thing left to watch. You don't go looking for it. Everything else disappears, so that's the only thing left. So that's what it means. Aha. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you tell the ghost story about one day in Thailand in a hospital in the elevator and the nurse with her card? Thank you. I think that's for little Anna. That was actually a true ghost story. And what some of the other ones I've said were just jokes. But a true ghost story was, this was, I know the time, about 30... No, more than that, about 35 years ago, 36 years ago, in Sirirat Hospital, which is just over the river, you know, from the Sanamlu and the central field of Thailand. And it's the main hospital in Bangkok, it used to be, and the King of Thailand goes in there regularly now. And one morning, one of the doctors was just finishing the night shift. I was in the elevator with a nurse when it stopped at one of the levels of the hospital. And as it stopped, the elevator doors opened and there was a patient outside wanting to get in. As soon as the doctor saw that patient, he immediately reached for the closed door buttons, you know, the one which closes the doors. And he closed the doors before this poor patient could get in. And the nurse complained, "That's very unkind of you. Why did you close that door? There's a patient trying to get in." And the doctor was extremely agitated and said, "That was my patient. He died last night. That wasn't a real person, that was a ghost." And the doctor said, "You can tell that he died because in those days in Thailand, when a person died, they would put a red string around his wrist or her wrist. Now you can see some people wear these white strings around their wrist, pirit thread. In Thailand, the red string is reserved for people who died." And so he told the nurse, "Didn't you see the red thread on his wrist? He's dead. There was a ghost trying to get in. He's just outside the doors right now." Which was really scary. And at that, the nurse lifted up her hand. "I've got a red string too. Does that mean I can't get in?" And that was the story which the doctor told when he came to. They found him unconscious on the floor of the elevator. And when they sort of revived him, that's the story, that's as far as he knew what happened. He didn't know what happened to the nurse. There was a ghost inside the elevator and one outside as well. And when they checked, you know, that nurse, because he could describe her, she died on the way to work in a car crash. She was trying to get to work. I thought she was at work, but she was a ghost. And there was a ghost outside too. That's scary. And one evening, again on my New Year's Eve party, I showed a little video clip, from Thai TV. It was based on that story. They had a patient in a wheelchair, you know, all bound up, you know, couldn't move at all, and a nurse behind him. And the elevator stopped, and the patient came in. She looked a bit freaky. And then the door closed, and they said, "What floor do you want to go into?" And the patient said, "Number 13. He said, "There is no number 13. "Yes, there is." And the elevator stopped between 12 and 14, because there was no 13 floors in hotels and many hospitals. And the patient just walked through the door. And at that, the nurse was, "Ah!" and fainted. And the patient, "Oh, I want to go home, I want to go home." And then it flipped. I forget what brand of vitamins. And he says, "If you don't take vitamins from our company, you'll end up in hospital and this might happen to you. Buy our vitamins." It was an advertisement, but it was so funny to see that. So well done. Knowing that these things do happen in hospitals. There's lots of ghosts in hospitals. There's somebody here from JB. They told me the other day, but I don't know if you know Dr. Wong at Metta Lodge. He's been in a doctor for a long time in the old English hospital in Johor. And he says there's lots of ghosts all over the place in the hospitals. And I asked him for one of his best stories, and he said he was doing an operation in the theatre. You know, and you know, he was looking at the body, and he asked the nurse for a scalpel or something, so he put his hand behind there and he got the scalpel, and then he saw the nurse was on the opposite side. No one was behind him. The ghost gave him a scalpel. They're very kind and helpful, these ghosts. So don't be scared of them, unless you're in an elevator with one inside and one outside. Ooh. And those are both true stories, real ghosts. But the most weird ghost story, this is the weirdest one. Another true story. I think it happened in Adelaide, I believe. There was... woman getting married. And it's a custom in Australia, I don't know if it's the same in other countries, that the bride always arrives late, on purpose. Just now to set the scene, who's in charge of this marriage. But it's a tradition. So she arrived 5 minutes late with her father, you know, in the big car, in a white dress. When she came out from the car, she got the news that the groom hadn't arrived yet. The one she was to marry wasn't there. So she got a bit scared, perturbed, but they had a very good relationship, so she didn't really think that, you know, he would let her down. So she waited. And as the minutes went past, she got more concerned. Now maybe she had been stood up, or maybe something had happened to him. So after about 20 minutes, she was so relieved to see him running up the road towards her. And she soon realized why he was late, because he was all dirty, a bit of cuts and bruises on him, and his wedding suit was all dirty. He'd obviously been in an accident. He said he had been in a car accident. And she said, "We're going to cancel a wedding. I'm going to take you to hospital." And he said, "No, I'm going through this wedding. I'm just going in the men's room to clean up. We'll go through with this." So that's what he did. Went in the men's room, cleaned himself up as best he could, and they went through with the wedding. You know, with exchanging rings, the kiss, and even signing the marriage register. And after the photographs, the confetti, whatever they did then, the two of them got in the car to spend a little bit of time alone as they went to the place for the reception, for the party after the wedding. And because he was still a bit shaky, she drove, and he was in the passenger seat. And everyone else followed behind. And then halfway on the journey to the reception center, they saw the car stopped, and the driver, the bride, was hysterical, weeping outside. And no sign of the groom. Well, they asked, "Where is he? Where is he?" And she reported that they were just driving down, he was sitting next to her, and then without any warning, he suddenly disappeared into thin air. He vanished. And they later found that the place where he vanished was the place a couple of hours later he died in a fatal car crash. It was the girl who married the ghost. And I can understand why it works. He wanted to marry her so much that he managed to create a body and go to that church. A body which was solid enough, which is quite rare, solid enough to actually to be kissed and to sign a register. That's one of the freakiest ghost stories. And I always tell people, be very careful. If you go out with somebody and you see this beautiful girl and you kiss her, it doesn't mean she's not a ghost. Spooky, but true. That's a really spooky story. But it actually just shows us how the will, you know, really, he was really so much in love, he really wanted to go through with this wedding ceremony, so much. That desire, that craving, I can understand how that works. Created a body, just for that time. Just to get through the ceremony. Anyway, next question. "I'm so glad that I can meet you in my life and so lucky I can join your retreat. My give one sharing here. Practice sometimes may be difficult and tough and lost, but I hope all of us will cherish the time we can practice here. Now, the world is full of wars and fighting. Many people stay in fear, hopelessness every day. We are so lucky we can stay in such a beautiful, peaceful land for this place here, built up by Ajahn and his Sangha. Please raise up our compassion and peaceful mind during our practice because of all the energies benefiting our practice and also saving the world too. Enlightenment maybe is our destination, but if we cherish the process between enlightenment, we can take the most happiness in Dharma." Thank you, yeah. It is true that it doesn't matter if you don't get enlightened or jhanas. The very fact that you're here having a very peaceful 9 days, that's enough. It's a wonderful thing just to be here. If you do get nimittas and jhana, that's just gravy, that's bonus. That's the free gift in the cornflakes box. But the cornflakes is the most important thing. Just being here. Venerable Ajahn, can we offer merits to our dead parents after doing some good deed? Are they able to take our merits and get a good birth? Sometimes they can receive your wish of good karma. Sometimes they can't. If they've already been reborn as a human being, or if in their Samdeva realm, of course, they can't receive it. And especially if they're born in the heaven realm, I say that's like sending a donation to Bill Gates. He can receive it, but he doesn't really need it, and for him it's just a drop in the ocean. So if someone, if your father or mother is a heavenly being, and you send them merit, then they've got more merit than you have. So it doesn't mean much to them. But whether they receive it or not is not the point. It's wonderful that you give it. And you remember your parents, your teachers, your friends. It's called gratitude. And every time that we express our gratitude, you want to give something to those people we love. And if they're dead, what can you give to them? You can give the merits which you've made. You're meditating for them. You're giving donations for them. You're keeping the precepts for them, because that's what would really inspire them. You don't know if they can see you or not, but if they could, they'd be so proud. I often think of that, my father, my mother, if they could see me, they'd be so proud. Well done, son. That's my boy. And they'd be very proud of that. And that makes me happy. So you can share your merits, even if they don't receive them. Okay. Please tell us one of the jokes you like most. You really want to suffer, don't you? Okay, what's a joke I've been telling people recently? There's a couple of jokes, but the one about the Russian Englishman and Russian Englishman and American. Have you heard that joke? Okay. A Russian, it's very topical too, if you've read the newspapers recently. A Russian, American and Englishman were having a drink one day, and the Englishman said, you know, I'm going to pay for this round of drinks because I just got an email from my son, who's a doctor, and he's just cleared $1 million for his year of practice. He's a specialist. He's made $1 million just in 1 year. So proud of him. And America says, oh, that's nothing. My son is a lawyer. He's cleared $3 million in the last financial year. And the Russian said, oh, that's nothing. My son cleared $10 million last year. What does he do? Asked the other two. Oh, he's a sports mechanic. A sports mechanic. He fixes soccer matches, cricket matches, tennis matches. Sports mechanic. So that's one joke. A nice one. Please tell us about the names of the main sutras which would be beneficial to find out about meditation. Obviously, Yanapanasati is the best. But there's all types of sutras all over the place. I sometimes like to quote the Gopika Moggallana Sutta, where just after the Buddha passed away, Ananda, again, his chief attendant, was the go-to person. And so people would ask Ananda, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend when he was alive? And Ananda replied, the Buddha only recommended 4 types of meditation during his lifetime. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. I like things like that because it just makes the point very clear that that's the type of meditation the Buddha praised. So there's lots of them, but if you want to start, maybe you can start with the middle-length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya. That's usually all types of nice suttas. Read through those. If you want to get a bit deeper, then maybe go to the Samyutta Nikaya. There's some wonderful suttas in there. But all over, you find your favorites, and you can't say that one is better than others. Dear Venerable, where does the illusion of self come from? Is it cultural conditioning when our parents teach us we are a separate entity, or is it through our senses giving false perceptions to reality, or something completely different? Now you come into this life with an illusion of self. Now, from your previous lives, your previous existence, you were before, you know, in different lives, and that illusion continues on for this life. And if you don't break it in this life, you'll have it in the next life as well. That's why it's so difficult to break through. It's reinforced by cultures and reinforced by education. So it's a tough one to break through. But tomorrow, in the insight talk, I'll show how you break through it. Do you have any hints on how we can develop our patience? I'll answer that later. Watching a tree is different to watching your breath. The tree has form, breath has no form. Is this correct? Breath is a feeling. Oh, it's an interesting thing. First of all, the breath is a feeling, but even the tree is also a feeling. You're seeing it as a sight, but it also has feeling. Every object also is accompanied by a feeling as well. Seeing is a sight object. Breath is a physical object. It's done by touch at first. Some people have told me they're having difficulty when their breath gets very subtle and it vanishes, what's happening next? And one good way of understanding what's happening next is there are two ways you can see a tree. One is through your eyes and one is through your mind. You can know the tree or you can see the tree. Just like your breath, you can feel the breath through your fifth sense of touch. Or you can know the breath through the sixth sense of just knowing. And the two are a little bit different. And this is what happens sometimes. You know you feel the breath as a sense object of touch. Touch, it gets very, very fine, then it disappears. And what's left a lot of the time is you know the breath. You're still aware of the breath, but through a different sense door. Now through the mind, not through the sense of touch. And for many people, they think it's disappeared. It hasn't disappeared, you're just knowing it through a different sense door. Which is why I ask people, if your breath appears to disappear, if that's what you assume it's disappeared, it may not have disappeared, it's just seeing it through a different sense. Instead of smelling the food, you're tasting it. Knowing these things through a different sense door. So if the breath does disappear, don't do anything, just wait there, see what happens. Maybe you'll be able to realize you're not feeling the breath anymore, you're knowing it. Experience is very different, but it's still the same breath. I am a new meditator. My mind is all over the place. Very hard to be in the present moment. Please help me. Don't try to be in the present moment. Don't let the mind be all over the place. I haven't told this story on this retreat. It's one of my favorite stories. That after 5 years of training as a monk, I was allowed to go wandering off by myself through Thailand. And for the rains retreat, I found the perfect monastery for me. I was English. And my monastery I found in the north of Thailand was in the middle of a tea plantation. To me, that was the closest thing on earth to Nibbana. As much tea as I wanted for free. And it was also high in the mountains, so it was cool. You didn't have the hot weather to contend to. And the lay people, there was only one village. And those village, all they wanted to do was to feed me. They weren't interested in meditation or Dharma talks. And that really suited me. You just feed me and leave me alone. Yeah, that's what we want to do. And there was a cave there as well, a beautiful cave. And to this day, there were so many bats in that cave. And I used to spend so many happy hours meditating in that cave. To this day, whenever I smell bat poo, bat shit, it's a beautiful smell to me. It brings back these wonderful memories of, you know, these 6 months, you know, in this monastery with a bat cave. So, you know, I smell bat poo, and it's beautiful. It's fragrant because it brings back memories, good associations. So I was having a wonderful time in there for the first couple of months. And I was by myself. No one else was there. It was abandoned. And I asked the lay people, why don't more people come here? They said it's too quiet for them. Nothing happening. And I loved that, I thought, until my mind started getting restless. And it got more restless and more restless. And it wasn't so much the mind was thinking a lot. It was the sort of stuff it was thinking about. I started thinking about old girlfriends. I wonder where she is now. Whether, is she still available? Shut up, Ajahn Brahm. You started thinking of all the great sex. No, I'm not supposed to think of sex. I'm a monk. And fantasies. And it got to the point where I was really trying hard to stop these thoughts coming into my mind. I was a monk. I loved being a monk. But these thoughts would just come in. And I could not get them out. And I try and watch the breath, come breathing in, breathing out. And these thoughts would break down the doors and come in. And it was just so tiring, fighting my mind. And also, I never had anyone to talk to. So I was getting into such a terrible place once. I went into the main hall. And look, you know, being a physicist, I wasn't a faithful Buddhist. All this stuff about psychic powers and chanting and stuff, I didn't really believe in. But when you're desperate, you know, you believe in anything. So I actually lit some incense in front of the Buddha statue and basically asked for help. Help me, I'm in big trouble. And an idea came up to my mind, and it was to do a deal. Because, you know, that's what you do in the West, you do deals. And so my deal was that I would behave most of the day and watch my breath. But for 1 hour every afternoon, I would allow my mind to think whatever thought it wanted, without restrictions, sexy thoughts, weird thoughts, strange thoughts, any thought whatsoever, was allowed between 3 to 4 p.m. The idea was that if you could think sexy thoughts, fantasies, whatever, for 1 hour, get it out of the way, do whatever you want, and the rest of the time behave. That was what I thought was fair. But you know what happened? It was as difficult as before. Still those thoughts kept coming in my mind. It was such a hard battle. But then when it got to 3 p.m. Now I am very, if I make a promise, I try and keep it. So at 3 p.m. I went to my room, leaned back, put my feet out and said, okay mind, whatever you want to think about, old girlfriends, sex, anything, go for it. And for the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. With no thoughts coming in my mind at all. It was really weird. It's not what I expected. But I learned a lot from that. I realized very quickly, and it's been confirmed ever since, by trying to stop those thoughts, I was actually feeding them, making them stronger and stronger and stronger, which was the problem. When I let go, allow things to be, my mind became so peaceful. I put down the cup, which I did on the first day with Venerable Chaga as my witness. You put down the cup and it became still all by itself. And those were the sorts of things I remember my teacher saying so many times, let go! The leaf only blows, only goes up and down because of the wind. If you stop the wind of wanting, it gets very still. So for 1 hour I didn't want anything. Whatever you want to do, mind, do. And it became still. So if you're the new meditator, your mind is wandering all over the place. It's find out what's making it go all over the place. It's because you want something. You're blowing on the leaf. So just stop blowing. Whatever the mind wants to do, it can do. No wanting, no controlling. Totally let go. And you'll be surprised how quickly your mind becomes peaceful. And if that's all you learn on this retreat, you've learned a huge insight. Next one. The Dalai Lama is said to be an enlightened being who keeps being reborn due to compassion for suffering sentient beings. Please comment. If you are fully enlightened, you just cannot be reborn, whether you want to or not. It's just not up to you. So that's one of the reasons why the Dalai Lama said, this is the last time. And when he made that announcement, this is his last time as the Dalai Lama, the communist government in China said, I'm sorry, but you're not allowed not to get reborn. And it's such a stupid comment. So they were exerting their control of the Dalai Lama and said, you must be reborn. You've got no chain in. As if some government can control you that way. So, if you're really enlightened, you don't get reborn. Can you introduce the monks and nuns at your side? They are inspiring. So this is monk number one, monk number two, monk number three. That's nun number one, number two, number three, number four. What's in a name anyway? A nun by any other name smells so inspiring. Shakespeare said. Okay, this is Chaga, that's Dhammapada, that's Boots, Nibbuto. And that is Pasada, that is Karunika, that is, I can't do your name because you do it in Chinese, and Genti. So do you want to pronounce your name? Xin Shui?
Jiyong.
Jiyong. Very good. So are they good nuns? Are they good monks? How do you know? The ones who smile the most are the best. Thank you. You better start smiling, man. It's quick. Thank you so much for this morning's talk. It really helped and inspired me. Perfect timing. Very good. Does a person with severe dementia or even Alzheimer's generate less karma because they only do or remember very basic things, such as eat, sleep, seems very basic intention just to survive for the body. Yeah, it's very hard to see how anyone with Alzheimer's or dementia can make any good or bad karma, because all karma is because of intention. You have to intend to do something. If you're not really quite sure what you're doing, where you are, there cannot be really much karma being done there at all. But an interesting thing about Alzheimer's or dementia, it's so common that just before a person dies, they become clear again. I was not with my mother had dementia for many years, but I was in Australia, she was in England, so I wasn't with her when she died. I'd been really interested to have been with her when she died, because it happens so often, they've never been able to remember you for years. And then suddenly you're by the bedside, the doctors say they're going to go soon, and they open their eyes and say, oh, Peter, where have you been? They remember everybody. They get clarity. Because what happens at the end, just before you die? The mind separates from the brain. The brain is what's blocking everything up. And then so the brain just basically disappears and your mind is clear. You can see and hear, remember things. And the most amazing story of that apparently happened in New York. There was a gentleman with a brain tumor. And the brain tumor was aggressive, but it was growing at a gradual rate, so much so that the doctor could actually predict the day of the death and could predict all of the stages which are going to happen as the cancer was colonizing the other cells. Then you start to lose your ability to speak properly. You'd be able to lose your ability to move your bowels and stuff properly. And then your eventually all your brain which was left would just be able to do the most important functions, keep your heart going. And eventually there'd be no brain left to do that. You'd die. And so, this man was in a coma for a few days. Because there's nothing left to be able to speak or to remember. That part of the brain was just all been gone by the cancer. And so the whole family knew within a couple of hours that their loved one was about to die. So they're all around the bedside waiting for him his last breath. And then, no brain left almost, hadn't been in a coma for days, opened his eyes, leant up, and had his last conversation with his loved ones. Oh, nice to see you. This is what I want you to do. Thank you for being here with me for all these years. For 15 minutes. And the doctor who wrote the article, I wish I'd have kept it, but I can't find it anymore. The doctor who wrote the article said it's not supposed to happen. He didn't have any brain left at this time, but had memory, speech, looking around, seeing everybody, talking to them, and it's not supposed to happen. The closest thing which happened here in Australia, this woman who comes to Nonamara Temple, she was by her father's bedside when he was about to die, been in a coma for a few days, and with her sister, so either side of the bed, holding their father's hand, just waiting for that last breath, waiting, and they weren't paying much attention, really tired, waiting. And suddenly, without any warning, their father opened his eyes for the first time in days and just bent up and looked at his two daughters by the bedside. And they said that there wasn't plan. They said it almost synchronized, without plan, "We love you, Dad." And then he smiled and fell back and died. Not supposed to be possible. He was in a coma. But he was conscious in that last moment. And that's very common. So if you have dementia yourself, don't worry, because your last moments will be clear. The fog clears and you can remember things at last. Or if you're with somebody who's got dementia and you're with them at the very, very last. It doesn't happen all times, but it happens really quite often. People become clear in the last minute or two, maybe even longer. Fascinating. Has anyone here had experiences like that with someone with dementia? Okay. How does one create a burning desire or obsession for meditation? Please, no burning desires. We're in fire season now. There's so many bushfires around here. Any burning desire, we're going to report you to the police. An obsession. If you're obsessed with it, it doesn't work. It's very, very light. It's an inclination. It's just nothing else to do. Nothing makes more sense than meditating. Do you ever have a burning desire or obsession to sit and watch the sunset? Or is it just something you just love doing? So that's what we encourage. Something you just love doing. If the breath is very subtle and very hard to notice, what can we do? I think I've already answered that question. It's just, if it's very hard to notice, you're aware. What are you aware of? It could very well be that you're starting to perceive the breath through the mind sense rather than the sense of touch. It's changing its appearance. So just carry on. Whatever you're being aware of, be aware of that. Don't try and choose what you're aware of. Whatever's in front of your mind's eye is the most important thing in the world. So just watch it and care for it. And after a while, you get to know what it is. What's the difference between anatta and anatta-sanya? Sanya means the perception of non-self. Non-self is just the quality. You're all anatta, but some of you can perceive it, some of you can't. If anatta has sanya, it means dukkha, and anicca has dukkha-sanya. Anicca-sanya, yeah, they do. Dukkha-sanya, perceiving in the suffering of things, even in the things which you think is happiness. So perceiving, just even having a body, is a lot of suffering. If you can perceive the body as a lot of suffering, then when you die, actually you're not afraid of death. This is one of the things which people learn when they have near-death experiences. They know what it's like to die, and it's fun when once you're dead. Getting there is pain, but once you're dead, it's great. So, and then you have the understanding this body is a lot of suffering, even when it's healthy. And as for anicca-sanya, it's what do you rely on in this world? You can't rely on anything in this world. Everything is impermanent. Do you really think that you're going to listen to a talk tomorrow morning? I could be dead tonight. Anicca-sanya, or you could be dead. Impermanence. You're going to die one day, you know. And I love this little trick. Look at the number of people. There's about 80 people in this room. So, yeah, about 1.5 of you are going to be dead by this time next year. 1 or 2 of you are going to be dead. Just the law of probability, just statistics, that's all. Which 2 is it? And don't just look at the old ones. Young ones die too. Is that going to be you? That's energy. You can't rely on things. We always think, oh, we're going to do it tomorrow. We're going to do it next year. We don't know whether the next year is going to be there for you. That's anicca sanya. Or one of the nicest ways of doing anicca sanya is that when you go to breakfast tomorrow morning, just see how quickly all the bread disappears, or the jam. It doesn't last very long with you guys around. Anyway, yesterday while meditating, I experienced a nimitta which appeared as a yellow light. All of a sudden, became very bright, excellent, which gave me a start and end of meditation. Ah. At least that session afterwards, I realized that the light had only been experienced in my left eye. The sensation lasted many hours. It was not painful, but the feeling was there. Is it normal when a nimitta, or was it simply a nimitta from one of your tick-carrying, grass-pulling kangaroos? It really did happen. The experience was interesting. Indeed, it is interesting. It didn't actually happen in just the left eye, just in the field of vision. It appeared to be, you know, towards the left. Very bright, very brilliant. That's usually what happens the first time. Brilliant, but you don't know how to handle it. It's like a test. And when you experience nimittas again, that's the old nimitta, that's all. After a while, it just stays with you and centers. But at least you had a nice nimitta, and it was very powerful, it was very bright. After a while, it can stay with you a long time. Just like when you first try to meditate on the breath. Sometimes you could only watch 3 or 4 breaths. And now you can watch the breath without missing one for a long period of time. See, you've got some progress here. Nimitta comes up, and after a while, you can actually watch it for a long period of time. And you get very powerful meditations then, really a lot of happiness. And also, really powerful good health. So, you're getting somewhere. Dear Ajahn, Lord Buddha has advised that lay people how to manage their own wealth while living a good life. Please explain. Also, please tell the name of the sutras to refer to. Or, what it was the one about managing your wealth? I think they said something about split it into 4 parts. One was for your family, one was for your enjoyment, one was digging under the ground for the rainy day, and the other one was to do charity work. It doesn't mean like a tithe where you have to give 10% to the church, and the Buddha said 25%, that's a quarter. It doesn't mean that, it's just according to your means. Don't always spend it by yourself, but some of it should go to your own happiness. Some of it go looking after your family. Some of it investment for the future, and some of it for doing social work. So, you know, to be split up basically those 4 ways. And they always say that they got the abhayamukha, the roads to the openings, the path to ruin, and things like gambling and drinking were always supposed to be where your wealth gets lost very, very quickly. So, no, don't gamble the money. It's just such an obvious thing. If you go to a casino, people make so much money of the casino by running them. And where does that money come from? It's because stupid people are losing. And we always think, this is the ego again, that we can beat the odds. We can't beat the odds. The odds always beat you. And sometimes people go to monks, or they go to temples, or they go to stuff, thinking they can beat the odds. Sometimes the monks know how to beat the odds, but they won't tell you, because this is what happened to Ayakama. This is Ayakama's story. Absolutely true story. I checked it out many times. And also the lady who was with her at the time, Anya, she's over in Sydney. And they were, Ayakama was teaching a retreat like this in England. Once the retreat was finished, she was going from the retreat house to Heathrow Airport to take a plane and think back to Germany. And on the way they stopped for lunch, you know, before midday. And the place they stopped for lunch was next to a pub. If ever you go to England, the pubs, you know, they're not like bars where people just get drunk all the time. They're social hubs. And they've often got like a restaurant attached to the pub. But they had to go through the front of the pub to get into the restaurant, which was no problem at all. So Ayakama was finishing her lunch, and her driver had an excess of English coins, you know, £1 or £2 coins. And, you know, it's a waste of time trying to change those at the currency exchange at the airport, because it wasn't enough. They probably charge you much more in fees than they would give you in return in German euros or whatever it was at the time. So she just had his extra coins just to get rid of them. There was one of these, they call them in Australia, pokies. In England they're called one-armed bandits. These little slot machines and you pull the handle and these little things go round and round and round, and if they get jackpot or three gold bars or whatever, then you win a prize. So she's putting these coins in there just to get rid of them, and putting the handle, nothing, another coin in, pull the handle, just to get rid of the coins. And she just put the coin in. She hadn't put the handle in, pulled the handle yet, when Ayakema came past. And Anya said to her, "You've got all the good karma, you pull the handle." And Ayakema lost her mind from this just for a minute. You're not supposed to pull the handle, but she did. She pulled the handle. And what happened next? Wheels went round, jackpot. And all this money, all these hundreds, 300, 400, lots of coins, came right onto her her robe and all over the floor. She won the jackpot. And everybody in the bar stopped as they saw this nun had just emptied the machine of the jackpot. And she was stunned as well, because totally just mindless, I pull it without thinking of the consequences. And the bartender rang the bell, ding, ding, ding. Because it was the rule, it was a custom, a tradition, and you had to keep these traditions, that whoever won the jackpot had to buy a round of drinks to everyone in the bar. And that was the first time in 25 centuries that a Buddhist nun or monk bought drinks for everybody. Alcohol, beer, whiskies, gin and teas. That's a very true story. So don't ask me to pull any handles of poker machines. We might win. We'd be in big trouble then. So it's amazing. These things actually happen. She's only ever done that once and won the jackpot. Weird, isn't it? "Dear Ajahn Brahm, meditation hall during the daytime is nice and bright, very bright, a bit hard to meditate. What would you do about this?" Close your eyes. And if it's still too bright for you during the day, has anyone got, I gave a couple of people some eye shades? Because, have you got any of them here? Can you hold them up so you see what I've got? I can have these for you. If you want to ask me for these eye shades, because I travel on Singapore Airlines a lot. You got some as well, Tessie. I travel so much on Singapore Airlines, they always give me these eye shades, and I collect them to use on retreats. So, because that means that Singapore Airlines gets some good karma, which means that they don't crash, which keeps me safe. So it's my way of making sure that I get to my destination. So if you want one of those eye shades, just come and ask me. I've got lots in the office. Which means you can wear those eye shades and it's nice and dark. I also use those eye shades in particular to people when they start getting limiters. Because people see these lights in their mind, they think, oh, it can't be a limiter, it must be some light flashing in their eyes. So I give them these eye shades because they know they've got the eye shades on, it cannot be a light. It has to be a limiter. So I got those eye shades also, so people who have any doubts, they can put those eye shades on and it convinces them 100% that this is a real limiter. "Can you please describe how to do reflections?" Yes. You stand in the bathroom in front of the mirror, and there you can do reflection. It's getting late, so I'm going through this very quickly. The reflections on impermanence, unsatisfied. Well, I'll see if I can bring that up into the insight talk tomorrow. "Our children do not belong to us, but it's because of the same connections from an early life or birth they become our children, or we become their parents. What is a Buddhist way of analysing this situation?" It's if you can only remember they're only your children for a time being. They're in your care. And then they leave. You know they leave. But how many of you are living in the country where you were born? I'm not. Many of you aren't. You're born in one country, now you're living in Australia or some other place. Children today go all over the world. So you don't own them. You're separated for such a long distance. So that's why we change our perception of children. We don't ever think they're mine, ours. And sometimes the children hate that when you own them and control them, especially when they get to the teenage years and always telling, you know, you're always telling your children what to do and really embarrassing your children. I say, "Mom, look, you know, I'm old now. I'm 40. I know what to do." "No, you're not, darling. You've got to wash behind your ears. You've got a new clean pair of underpants on." There comes a time when you have to let your kids go. And just, you know, when they're capable, then kick them out. If we're constantly practicing mindfulness through meditation, will we have lesser dreams in our sleep? Any scientific correlation? There's lots of experiments which have been done with mindfulness. I don't know of the seeing if there is any correlation with less dreams, because it's sometimes hard to know if you've had a dream, because many of the dreams you have you don't remember when you wake up. So of course they may be able to see what type of sleep patterns you are having, but imagine you go to sleep and you've got all this electronic equipment on your head. For some of us it's hard to go to sleep anyway. Imagine you've got some gizmos all on your head and all these things and all these people going around you just looking, checking you out. It's impossible to go to sleep sometimes. So I think it's a very difficult thing to know, except anecdotally. You know, if you're very peaceful, you don't need many dreams. If you're working hard, then you do have dreams. So I think it does lessen the amount of dreams. See, when I talk about dreams, I start to yawn. I have found there is so much nice energy in the meditation hall that it makes it easier to meditate in there than in my room. Some parts of the woods also give something energy from walking meditation. Where does this energy come from? It comes from all the people who have been meditating here before. Now, places do suck up energy. And I like to tell the story of going on pilgrimage once. We started off in Kathmandu. And of course people wanted to go and see the old city in Kathmandu. I was getting really bored but got no choice. And you know, I was being a bit rebellious. I was lagging behind the main group. And I went through one gateway. And when I went to this courtyard of the old palace in Kathmandu, it was some of the worst energy I'd ever experienced in my life. I just wanted to get out of there straight away. This was a really dark place, black place. And it was so pronounced, I asked the guide, "What on earth is that place?" And the guide was actually quite impressed, because that's the place, the old Hindu kings of Kathmandu, they're not there anymore. That's where they used to do the annual slaughter of the cows and pigs and goats, whatever they did. It was supposed to be the way to ensure their reign had longevity. And that's where they would slaughter all these animals every year ritually. And you went in there. And that really felt terrible. I felt really bad energy in there. And it's because those things happen that they do leave sort of some, what's called some echo. And you go to other places. Like one of my favorite places is the Vulture's Peak, where the Buddha would meditate for such a long time. That's got powerful energy. You sit there and wow. You know, you really fly. You're picking up on the Buddha's energy. And you go to, say, the Bodhinyana, if you haven't been there yet, please go at least once to the hall at Bodhinyana Monastery. Because the front especially, that's got powerful energy in there. This place is coming up, but it's not as well used as the hall in Bodhinyana Monastery. So this is getting some good energy, but it's not as powerful as in Bodhinyana. And that hall there is really powerful. And there's other places you find in the world. You know, you can sit there and you get peaceful so easily. So, places do soak up the energy of the past. You can feel it sometimes. Bad energy, good energy. So how can you develop similar energy for meditation back home? I usually say this on the last day of the retreat, but I'm now going to say it. Is find a place in your house or your apartment. And just even if it's only a corner of your bedroom, doesn't matter where, if you've got more space, room under the stairs, a cupboard, or even a full room, and make that your meditation room, your shrine room, and don't do anything else there. And that's the place where you go to meditate, to read Dharma books, listen to CDs, or sort of podcasts of the Dharma. But don't use it for anything else. Chanting maybe, but it has to be something which is to do with the practice. And you'll find after the days, the weeks, the months, the years, that just build up energy. It's much easier to meditate there. And as happened to a couple here in Perth, they used under the stairs of their house in Perth. And they said, what happened? They had two young kids, 5 or 6, a girl and a boy, something around that age. And like most children, they had a fight. And the elder brother hit his younger sister, punched her, out of frustration. And the first time the little girl had been hit, she was crying her eyes out, ran inside the house. Where did she run to? The meditation room. She sat down in there. And that's why the parents told me, it's amazing. She's not usually allowed in there. But she was so emotionally hurt. Not the hurt of the smack of her brother, but there was her brother, the one she loved, and she got hit. She was so emotionally upset, she went to the place that she felt was the best place to heal, the meditation room. She felt the energy there, and that's where she went, without being told. So beings do actually go in there, they feel it's got good energy. Can a monk do a simple exercise or stretching beside walking? Yes, I just exercise my mouth by talking, and I do 10 push-ups every morning. You know my 10 push-ups every morning? I stand in front of the mirror, look at myself, put my fingers on either edge of my mouth. 1, 2, 3, 4. I do smiling exercise because I have to have many photographs taken of me and say, smile, smile. I've got to do this a lot, so it takes exercise to be able to smile like this. Yeah, monks do exercises, they do Tai Chi, they yoga, the walking, lots of stuff. Can a monk take a nap if he is tired before meditation? Of course you can take a nap. Monks are human beings. Can a monk go to the toilet before meditation? Of course they can. In one of the Q&A sessions, you did mention our Buddha Gautama had been a disciple or a close associate of a previous Buddha. A disciple, a monk under the previous Buddha. As such, he may have learned and understood the principles from previous Buddha. Exactly. If so, why did our Buddha spend 6 long years to discover and understand the same principles? Because you forget. People who can remember their past lives, they often remember them when they're born, and usually when they can start to speak, they say, you know, you're not my real mummy, I want to go to my real mummy, I want to go home. So some of the children do remember that in their first years of life, up to around about the age of 6 or 7. And then those memories from a previous life tend to fade away, you don't remember them anymore. And then, basically, you have to start from scratch again, but there's still something deep in the mind, you know, which is inclining you towards what you did before. So that would, even the Dalai Lama says, for the first few years he could remember who he was in his previous life, but after 6 or 7 years those memories just faded away. Or like some people, there's one of our committee members, she was Sri Lankan, and her, is it son or daughter, insisted on using chopsticks for the first years of its life. Would only like Chinese food, not Sri Lankan food. It's obvious it was like a Chinese person before got born into their family. But after 5, 6, 7 years, they stopped liking Chinese food and started liking Sri Lankan food. So, you know, that past life just tends to fade away after 6 or 7 years. So for the Buddha, they would have not, by the time he was a young man, would not really remember that past life. But maybe when he was born, and he supposed to have put his finger up saying, this is my last life. Perhaps because he knew it was his last life. At that time he could remember, but then forgets. Does Northern Thailand Buddhism practice using labeling technique, Mahasi Sayadaw, in meditation? Why is it different? It seems they do not encourage nimitta too. Despite the difference, does that mean the result will be the same? Like all roads lead to Rome, it's just what technique works for us. As long as there is the Eightfold Path, then it works. So there has to be keeping precepts. There also has to be the jhanas. And sometimes people do the Mahasi technique, and sometimes, despite what they're doing, they get so still and peaceful, they get nimittas, they get jhanas. But sometimes they're not encouraged. Because what happened in the Mahasi technique, and this is another thing for you to know, the Mahasi side, or the original one, he knew all about jhanas, and that they decided to teach vipassana for lay people, because they thought it was too difficult for you guys to get jhanas. Vipassana started off as a second class meditation for lay people. Monks didn't do vipassana, they did jhanas. But then it became quite popular, quite famous, and people didn't understand its original idea, which was not that good anyway, and it became a practice in its own way. And people were actually saying, they became so proud of their vipassana, they said, it's the only way, the only way to enlightenment is satipatthana. Number one, satipatthana is not vipassana, and the only way to enlightenment is always the Eightfold Path. The actual sutta does not mean the only way. That is, any Pali, you don't have to be a Pali scholar. Anyone knows a little bit of Pali, know the word never ever means that. But because northern Thailand is very close to Burma, there's a lot of influence from Burma there. So that's why there's a few places which do the Vipassana Mahasi Sayadaw teaching. But jhanas are the most prevalent amongst the monks. Ego is primary factor in my thought and actions presently. What I am finding difficult to grasp is this is the something even when I am doing good things. This is the case even when I'm doing good things. Your thoughts, please. Indeed, a lot of times we do good things actually to prove something to ourselves or others. And that's why that even when we're meditating, we should let go of even good things, let alone bad things. Don't do anything. Let it all go. That's a tough thing for us to do. But tomorrow, because it's 9:30, I'm going to finish now. Tomorrow I'm going to say all about how your ego, your sense of self, how that illusion fades away. So tomorrow, those who pay attention will all disappear. You are going to vanish. And so my last words to you, get lost. You're going to vanish. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And that's actually pretty good. I've only got a few questions left in here. So I've made progress today. Probably get more questions tomorrow, but nevertheless, good evening. So have a wonderful sleep tonight. Maybe no dreams. We'll see you all in the morning. Maybe. Who knows?